If it becomes law, at least one Republican lawmaker threatens to challenge it at the ballot box. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.
Bermuda is under a tropical storm warning ahead of Hurricane Bill. The storm is expected to generate dangerous flooding along the island's coast today and tomorrow. Bill is a Category 3 with top winds near 115 miles per hour. Forecasters say it has weakened and is becoming less organized, but they warn the hurricane still has the potential to regain strength. The storm's expected to generate dangerous waves and riptides along much of the U.S.'s eastern coastline this weekend. On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 130 points at 94.87. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Kathy Murphy was a founding member of the Champaign-Urbana Theater Company and its unifying life force. This Saturday in Champaign, a group of her friends and colleagues will present Kathy Murphy Encore, an evening of entertainment and appreciation to raise money for a scholarship in her name. A few of those friends will join us on the Friday edition of Live and Local, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we have as our guest Richard Haass. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and has held that post since July of 2003. He's the author or editor of 11 books on American foreign policy. This morning we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his most recent. The title of the book is War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars. It's published by Simon & Schuster and has just recently come out. Our guest was a member of the National Security Council staff in the first Bush administration and then worked in the State Department in the second administration. And he makes the argument that looking at these two wars, one, the first, was necessary, but the second, he says, was not. He says it was a bad choice. It was poorly conceived and poorly implemented. And Dr. Haass, hello.
Morning, I guess. So maybe now it's good afternoon.
Here's still morning. So in any case, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it. You were one of a handful of people that were in this unique position. That is, you had a significant position during both of these conflicts. And I know that you've talked about just, in fact, how unusual this really is, that indeed we had these two significant conflicts involving the United States, both involving Iraq, both involving Saddam Hussein, and interestingly enough, both involving presidents named Bush. And all of that coming together, it seems pretty unlikely, and being part of that, perhaps for somebody like you and for the others in the administration, seems even more unlikely.
Oh, yeah. 20 years ago, which was when the Berlin Wall came down and one era of history, the Cold War, ended and this new one began. If you and I and anyone listening to this show had been sitting together over a meal and we'd said, what kind of odds would you give me on the following? You could have gotten any odds you could imagine. Just inconceivable that people would have predicted that two of the most significant events of the last two decades would prove to be, as you said, two wars between a President Bush, no different ones, and an Iraq headed by Saddam Hussein. And you're right, it was myself along with people like Bob Gates, who was the Deputy National Security Advisor in the first Iraq War and then came on as the Defense Secretary late in the second, but also Colin Powell, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff the first time around, and then the Secretary of State the second, Dick Cheney, who moved from Secretary of Defense to Vice President. Paul Wolfowitz was the number three guy in the Pentagon in the first war, the number two guy in the second. So there really weren't many of us who served in a policymaking role in both. And as you said, this really was beyond anyone's imagination.
Mm. for any president, I would expect that the decision to take the country to war might be the most difficult thing. Perhaps one would say it should be the most difficult thing, the most difficult decision you make. How, for you, if you ask this question, well, what are the necessary conditions that apply under in which you would give the advice, yes, this is the time to apply military force? You know, what's the difference between a justifiable war and one that's, you would say, it's not?
Well, wars of necessity are not that difficult to decide, simply because, as the word suggests, you don't really have a lot of discretion. So if your vital national interests are at stake and there's no other way to protect them, then you use military force. That to me is not that tough of a call, all things considered, though obviously it's never an easy call when you're involving human life. Wars of choice, though, are far more difficult because, again, as the word suggests, you do have alternatives, and that's what makes a war of choice a war of choice, is that you do, in fact, have policy alternatives, and usually the interests at stake are something less than vital. So the alternatives can range from doing nothing to turning to diplomacy to trying various types of economic sanctions or using covert action, what have you. But it's far more difficult in that category. And what you've got to persuade yourself, seems to me, is any decision to use force in that situation has to meet two tests. The first is that the likely benefits of using force will be greater than the likely costs. And you can't prove that in advance, but you can certainly, you know, try to make that case, be honest in your assessment. And secondly, not only does the use of force have to promise to yield more benefits than cost, but it has to look better than using the alternatives. So you've essentially got to do your homework and say, okay, what's likely to happen if I do nothing? What's the benefits and costs? What's likely to happen if I, say, turn to diplomacy? And at the end of the day, the use of force has to be the best option available under the circumstances if the decision to go to war is going to pass the justifiable test.
Mm. And your argument, at least in the first case, was, and I think you've also said, people have to consider where we were at the time. This was the opening of the post-Cold War era, that the world simply could not stand by and allow something like this, that is the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein, to stand. And that was, right. I think you've given points to the first President Bush for, in fact, saying, no, we're not going to do that.
Exactly right. That was that famous Sunday when he flew back from Camp David and landed at the White House, and I was the one sent out to meet him, and that's when he gave that rather dramatic announcement, this will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait will not stand, which words that Jim Baker said at the time. Baker was the Secretary of State, where he thought the most courageous words and the most important words of Bush's presidency. And what brought Bush to that point, this is Bush the father, the 41st president, was his sense that at the beginning of this new era, now that the Cold War had ended, you couldn't let an act of aggression on this scale stand, or it would teach the worst possible lesson all over the world. And secondly, Iraq already possessed 10% of the world's oil. Kuwait was another 10%, so that made it 20%. And if Iraq was able to get away with this, they would then be able to intimidate countries like Saudi Arabia. So Iraq would really have its hand on the throat of the world's oil. And the U.S. interest was not commercial. We were not interested in the profits of American oil companies, but we were interested in seeing that oil was not manipulated for political reasons by somebody like Saddam Hussein, or he was not able to get, you know, all the proceeds from oil to build up his military. So there were real strategic interests that led President Bush the senior to declare this will not stand. Mm.
Just I want to make sure I have already getting some calls going here. I want to make sure that people know who are on hold now. I will not make them wait forever. We'll get to them in just a moment. But let me just come back to that point, because I know for certain that as you talk about this, that I'm sure that again and again, people come back to this question of oil and its significance here as a motivating factor, because I know that there are people, certainly among the various things that I have heard people say about the second Iraq war, and I'm sure people, well, I know people said the same things about the first. They said, no, it plain and simple, full stop. It's about oil. That's all it's about, and would point to certain kinds of statements. For example, some famously quoted statements that Secretary of State Baker made. And I guess people might say, well, is this splitting hairs, saying that we have a strategic interest in not having one person have that control over the oil supply? And isn't it an awful fine difference between saying that's our strategic interest, that it's not really a commercial interest? We're not favoring particular people who are exploiting it. We just want to make sure that we have access.
Well, no, I don't think it's splitting hairs, because a commercial interest would imply that the United States was risking the lives of its young men and women in order to protect profits of American companies, and that to me would be wrong or even obscene, and it was not done. The first war was in part, again, for the strategic reason, and when you talk about oil as a strategic interest of the United States, that to me is nothing to apologize for. Oil, literally and figuratively, fuels our economy. It is central to our standard of living, ourselves and our trading partners around the world. So there's no reason to apologize for that, given its centrality to our functioning as a society, as an economy. Although, as I said, in the first Iraq War, it was not the only concern. At least as high, if not higher, was the what you might call the demonstration effect, the idea that this type of a naked aggression couldn't stand. In the second war, while again you had this strategic backdrop, and even though I did not support the second war when I was in the government, the argument was not about oil. The argument was about President Bush's, this in this case 43, his desire to democratize Iraq. And after he transformed Iraq, in his view, it would create a model and a momentum that would prove irresistible to the rest of the Middle East. That is what essentially, I believe, led to the second Iraq War. Never in either case, in either of the two decision-making cycles, if you will, did anyone walk into a room, did anyone write in a memo and say, we've got to do this because we have somehow got to protect the interests of American oil companies or anything like that. Just as an aside, 90% now of the world's oil is not controlled by the Exxon Mobils or the Chevrons or anyone else's. It's controlled by national oil companies of the producing countries. You know, so it's the state oil company of Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Russia, increasingly, or what have you. That's the way oil is now dominated in the world, not by private American companies.
Just one more question, and again, I'll get to the phones. I think one reason that people find it difficult to answer this question, why did we go to war in Iraq the second time, is that the administration, in the run-up to the war and even afterwards, continued to give different reasons. And we went through a lot of things. There initially, I guess, the big thing was weapons of mass destruction, which we ended up not finding. And from that, we went to promoting democracy. And that seemed to be the fallback position because it was the thing that everybody at least could agree on that. But it seemed that depending upon who you asked within the administration, maybe different people had different reasons. Do you think that there, in fact, was a consensus promotion of democracy in Iraq and the Middle East truly was the one thing that was at the center of it?
No, it's a good question. I don't believe there was a consensus. There were a few of us who did not favor going to war, but among those who did, often the stated reason was the weapons of mass destruction. But I thought that was something of a lowest common denominator. And people often trotted that out as an argument, but I don't really believe after 9/11 that's what motivated the president, in part because there was nothing new that we were aware of when it came to Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. Indeed, we later learned that he wasn't even hiding weapons of mass destruction. He was hiding the fact that he didn't possess weapons of mass destruction. So I never really believe that was the real issue. I think I describe it in the book as window dressing. And again, I really do believe this president, in this case Bush 43, wanted to do something bold, wanted to do something big. He wanted to do a consequential. He wanted to be a consequential president. After 9/11, He wanted to send a message to the world that the United States could still shape history and not simply be a victim of history. And for all those reasons, he was very attracted to the idea of changing the government, changing the regime in Iraq, transforming that country, and again, moving on to transform the part of the world that by any measure is the least successful, least democratic, least peaceful part of the world on the planet. I really do think that that is where his imagination took him. My problem with the whole idea is I thought it lacked any grounding in reality.
Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Richard Haass. He is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. From January 2001 until June of 2003, he was director of policy planning for the Department of State, where he was a principal advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Before that, he also served in the first Bush administration, that is of the first President Bush. From 89 until 1993, he was special assistant to President George H.W. Bush and also senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the staff of the National Security Council. He's the author or editor of 11 books on American foreign policy. The most recent deals with the subject here we're discussing, War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars. It's published by Simon & Schuster, just out. We have several callers here. We'll get to them again. We ask people please to keep your comments brief. That way we get as many callers as possible. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The first caller up in line is in Mahomet, and this is line one.
Yes.
Hello? Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Why is it that neither you nor anybody else ever mentions the fact that the two chief inspectors who had gone to Iraq 11 times, I heard both of them say that they were convinced, absolutely convinced, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Now, why is it that neither you or anybody else ever mentions that in your analysis of why we went to war?
Well, as I write at great length in the book, I, along with virtually every other person I ever met during these years, including everyone in the intelligence community in the United States government, as well as people in the French government, German government, as well as people in the UN, all thought Saddam possessed chemical and biological weapons. It was the explanation that accounted for all sorts of behaviors, from the fact that he wouldn't provide the information demanded by the UN inspectors, to the fact that he often frustrated them doing their jobs, and so forth. As it turned out, we were all wrong. But even if we had been right, and the fact that Saddam Hussein indeed did possess some chemical and biological weapons, I'm still not persuaded that that would have justified a war at that time. It wasn't clear to me he was about to do anything threatening. He wasn't, for example, about to reinvade Kuwait or invade Saudi Arabia. There was simply no new information that suggested to me that Saddam Hussein had suddenly become an immediate or imminent and unacceptable threat. And again, as it turned out, he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, which even reduced the degree to which he constituted a threat. But U.S. policy was made at the time with that assumption, that belief that he was hiding chemical and biological weapons, although not nuclear weapons.
Well, he had, excuse me, he had used them on his own people.
For sure.
And the people of Iran. And so whether he had them then or not, he had used them before. We already knew that.
You're exactly
and
right.
I am not convinced that he didn't have them. I mean, you say we found out he never had them. What you mean is we never found them. That doesn't mean he didn't have them. That doesn't mean he didn't ship them out of the country. I mean, our intelligence is, you know, so lacking in many areas, that areas of that part of the world, I don't think we'd ever know. But thank you very much.
Right.
Well, thank you. I mean, the call is correct in saying that he did use them both against his own people, the Kurds in the north, and against the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. That was one of the reasons that concerns were so high, that if, in fact, he did have chemical or biological weapons, there was no confidence he wouldn't use them again. Indeed, U.S. soldiers were prepared for what we thought was the high possibility he might decide to use chemical weapons or biological weapons against us in both wars. We actually prepared for that capability. They were never found, but I don't believe he had them anymore by the time of the second Iraq War. I believe if he had, we would have found some traces of them physically inside the country. If he had shipped them outside the country, we would have found some evidence of that. I simply believe it's highly implausible that he had them and somehow and either they're still there or something was done with them. I simply don't believe that's a serious possibility at this time.
All right, let's talk with another caller, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I heard, I think it was on the Jon Stewart show, that when Bush 41 was trying to promote a war against Iraq, that they summoned some influential congressman to Vice President Cheney's office, I think it might have been Dick Armey, and Cheney pulled out a suitcase and put it on the desk, the implication being that Iraq was developing nuclear weapons in a suitcase. Can you confirm or deny that story at all? That's, I only heard it one time, and I never heard anything else about it.
I can't. I can. You know, I simply don't know. I think you said Bush 41. You meant Bush 43. This is when Dick Cheney was vice president. Dick Armey.
Oh, yeah, 43.
Dick Armey, as you correctly said, was a congressman who actually opposed the war.
Oh, uh-huh.
He was a Republican who opposed the war, and I have some vague recollection of him reporting either a meeting with Cheney or an intelligence briefing or something, but I don't remember any graphic details such as you suggest, which is not to say it wasn't right. I just don't have any hard recollection, sorry.
Uh-huh. During the promotion of the war, where would you say it land on a spectrum here in terms of either poor intelligence or deliberately misleading the Congress to promote the war?
After, if we're talking about the second Iraq War, I think the problem was severalfold. One was poor intelligence, is what you would call a false positive. The intelligence community genuinely believed that Saddam Hussein possessed chemical and biological weapons. I do not believe the intelligence community was in any way inclined to mislead anyone. Indeed, the intelligence community, as the war went on, printed a lot of things that the Bush administration didn't much like. For example, it forecast how difficult the aftermath would be, and that basically suggested or predicted that an Iraq war was going to be an extraordinarily difficult and expensive proposition. This was clearly something President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld didn't want to hear. So I don't question the political orientation of the intelligence community, although, again, in fact, they got it wrong. No, I think this is a war generated by policymakers. They were policymakers in and around the 43rd president who saw this war of choice as one that, on balance, would be to this country's advantage. I believe they were wrong both in that decision, and they undermined their own decision by how they went about it. This was this was executed quite badly. So I think the political people, if you will, had an agenda, but not the intelligence people.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to line number three. Another caller in, also in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, I had a question about the first war, but that lady deserves more reply than she's gotten. Both the UN and our own inspector, Scott Ritter, said that Iraq had no more than minimal amounts of chemical weapons and not usable. There was every indication that he had complied with the requirements of the first armistice that he destroy all remaining chemical weapons. And the evidence was clearly that he had. As for shipping them out of the country, he was under constant aerial and satellite surveillance. We would have known if he was shipping things. And where would he have shipped them? To Iran? One has to be demented to think he would send them there. The Syrians wouldn't have been very cooperative. Turkey, our ally, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, where else would he have sent them?
Well, I'd say two things. One is I tend to agree with your second point. I never took seriously the possibility that Saddam Hussein would send the weapons of mass destruction, if in fact he did have them, outside the country. Saddam Hussein was many things, and one of them is he tended to, I guess we would call it in the vernacular, a control freak.
I agree.
He just he wasn't going to take that that risk. On the former, yeah, you had one or two individuals like Scott Ritter making certain claims, but this was overwhelmed by the body of evidence on the other side.
No, it wasn't.
In the intelligence community, in among the UN weapon inspectors, even governments like France that opposed going to war did not challenge the basic argument that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was not in compliance with UN resolutions. Part of the problem, I find it an interesting case study of misanalysis, if you will, that people assumed he had them and that every piece of intelligence they saw, they tended to interpret through the lens of that assumption. So if they saw certain types of vehicles moving around, or they saw certain types of imports coming into the country, or they saw dirt move somewhere, what have you, they always said, oh, aha, that proves that he's doing this with his weapons of mass destruction. And to me, one of the real lessons to take away from this intelligence failure is the danger of assumptions, the dangers of a certain mindset or groupthink, about how it leads people to reach the wrong conclusions simply because everything is based upon flawed assumptions.
I would completely disagree with you about the Europeans. They all assumed that he had minimal amounts of chemicals, but not operational.
Well,
and there was every bit of evidence that he had complied with the requirements of destroying those weapons.
Well, he couldn't
prove
that.
Furthermore, you minimize Scott Ritter, but he was our chief inspector.
Just to be clear, the purpose of the UN inspections regime was that Saddam Hussein had to demonstrate that he was in compliance. We, the world, did not have to discover noncompliance. He had to prove compliance with the various demands placed on him by the UN Security Council after the first Iraq war ended. In order to do that, one of the things he had to do was provide a full accounting of various materials and the like that Iraq had imported that would be potentially relevant to the production of weapons of mass destruction. He never did this. And as a result, the inspectors, we all thought, were looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. So the fact that people couldn't find things, quite honestly to me, and more important to others, didn't tell you an awful lot because Saddam Hussein simply hadn't provided the necessary information that the inspectors needed in order to do their job.
The question I'd wanted to raise was the necessity of the first war. I would agree with your premise that the second war was unnecessary. The first war, however, was in large measure provoked by our own policy in encouraging Saddam to invade Kuwait. We had our ambassador or envoy had told him we had no objection. We had no position.
Well, I was heavily involved in that, just to be clear. Our ambassador at the time, April Glaspie, told him that we had no position on the specific merits of the disagreement between Iraq and Kuwait, referring to disagreements over oil production quotas, boundaries, and so forth. She did not say we were indifferent to the use of force by Saddam Hussein or that we would not protect our vital national interests. The real reason he went to war is not because, as has been suggested by you and others, that somehow he was encouraged. He was not. He simply believed that the United States, and more important, his fellow Arabs, would not stand up to him. He simply believed that he could get away with it, and this was based upon his general feelings of contempt for his fellow Arabs and his view of the United States as weak. We have all sorts of information that he looked at what the United States did in Vietnam. He looked at the way we left Lebanon several years earlier, and he basically thought the United States didn't have the stomach for a confrontation, and that's why I believe that he felt he could essentially get away with this, but he was not encouraged to do this in any way.
I need to jump in here. We're past our midpoint. I have some other callers. Just very quickly, just to introduce one other point here, I know one of the things that you've said in talking about this is that within the administration, you're not just you personally, but I mean the belief of the administration was that right up until the eve of the invasion of Kuwait, you didn't think that he would do it. Is that, have I got that correct?
Right. I thought this was what you might call theater or gunboat diplomacy, that he was essentially pressuring or intimidating the Kuwaitis over their oil differences. Essentially, Kuwait was producing more oil than they said they would produce under OPEC quotas. The Iraqis were desperate for the price of oil to go up because they were in tough economic straits after the 8 years of a war with Iran. So the Iraqis, were angry with Kuwait, but I didn't believe until the last day that Iraq would go as far as it did. And what I don't know is whether Saddam, what we still don't know is when Saddam Hussein made the decision to do what he did. For all I know, he was bluffing up to that point. And then when the bluff didn't work, then he may have simply switched gears. None of us knows what went on inside his head.
Yeah. And then just again, briefly, when it comes to the second war, that I think that some people have a hard time understanding why Saddam Hussein would go to the wall and put himself in a position of going to war with the United States over weapons that he didn't even have.
It's one of those things that historians will scratch their head at, their heads over for years to come. And the only thing I can think of is two possibilities. One is that he was so afraid that if the world knew, or his own people knew, or his neighbors knew, that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, they would judge him as weak, and they would challenge his rule. Secondly, he may have once again underestimated the United States, and my hunch is he somehow believed that even if a storm was coming, he could somehow weather it. I don't believe that he thought that the United States would go as far as it actually went the second time around.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations and has had that job since July 2003. He was, from January 2001 until June 2003, director of policy planning for the Department of State, where he was a principal advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell. And some years before that, he also served in the first Bush administration. He was a special assistant to President George H.W. Bush and also senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the staff of the National Security Council. He's authored a number of books about American foreign policy. His most recent is War of Necessity, War of Choice, a memoir of two Iraq wars, published by Simon & Schuster. And we have some callers here. We will continue. We'll go next and talk with someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
One point that's always bothered me that's never raised for some reason with regard to the first Gulf War is the fact that no one seems to have given any thought to the fact that this country sent freeborn sons and daughters to fight for and defend two monarchies, to restore one monarchy and protect another monarchy against a despot. I always thought that was perfectly and utterly wrong, and all the arguments you've given in favor of why the first Bush administration reacted the way it did just never addressed that point, and perhaps you'd like to speak about that. And the other is that, say, let's assume for the sake of argument, Saddam did get control of another 10% of the world's oil and started misbehaving and so on and so forth. In my living memory, we've had two historical turning points. Oh, and by the way, with regard to those monarchs, the House of Saud wasn't particularly friendly to us back in the 70s, for those of us who remember the Arab oil embargo. We've had two opportunities, one the Arab oil embargo and then the events in 1990-91, to say, why don't we kick the habit? Why don't we just walk away from these things and let the rest of the world worry about where it gets its oil and so on and so forth, and we're going to get the point where we don't need to worry about that, wash our hands of the situation, walk away, leave these people to their devices, and see if we can live in peace, harmony, and brotherhood, and so forth. Respond to those two points as you wish, please. Thank you.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, the second point, I'm quite sympathetic to. I believe it is something of a scandal that 3.5 decades after the first Arab oil embargo that was put on, as people know, at the time of the 1973 Middle East War, that 3.5 decades later, we are using far more oil than we were then, and we're far more dependent on imports. And this, to me, is a failure of Democratic and Republican administrations. It's a failure of Democrats and Republicans in Congress. And this is, again, I don't think the word scandal is too long when it comes to public policy failures. And this is that this never should have been allowed to come to pass, and we have only ourselves to blame. So I basically say amen to that. On the first point on the restoration of authoritarian regimes, it to me represents what I would call one of the, at least to me, one of the most interesting part of these two wars. It's not simply, as we discussed at the beginning, you've got two wars fought between the United States, led by a guy named Bush, against Iraq, led by Saddam Hussein. But the two wars represent two very different approaches to American foreign policy. The first war, the Gulf War of 1991, did not, as you suggest, it did not go after the nature of, say, the Kuwaiti government or the Saudi government. The purpose, indeed, in the various UN resolutions was to restore the government of Kuwait, not to transform it. And President Bush, the senior, was very comfortable with this. His view that the principal purpose of American foreign policy was to deal with relations between countries and to, for example, make sure that this kind of aggression couldn't prevail. His son had a very different approach to foreign policy, and he saw the principal purpose of American foreign policy was to change not simply the foreign policy of other countries, but their very nature. And that's why he ultimately went to change the regime in Iraq and to build a democracy which he hoped would not only work there, but would set a model for others. So this this was a far more ambitious foreign policy. It's not one I tend to support. I believe it is simply too hard to accomplish in most cases. And I also believe that in many instances, the United States has to make the compromise of working with governments that are not democratic simply because we need their help in dealing with other immediate challenges, whether it's dealing with a non-democratic China over North Korea or a non-democratic Russia over Iran or what have you. That, to me, is simply what we have to be willing to do in order to deal with the world that exists. But again, what's one of the reasons I wrote this book is I just found it so interesting that these two wars were premised on the two competing basic notions of what this country's purpose ought to be in the world.
Next caller is in White Heath. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just have been listening to this interview, and what strikes me is that in the first Gulf War and in the second Gulf War, and you even admitted to yourself that you did not know if Saddam Hussein would go into Kuwait when he did, and then in the second Gulf War, everything was wrong. Our intelligence system and the advisors that advise our government have a terrible track record, especially in the recent years, and even since Vietnam, even or where, I don't know. I suppose I could look back years and years and find that our intelligence that we depend on to send our young men and women off to fight is based on assumptions rather than real facts. And I think that's really sad that we have to depend on that. I don't know if you address that in your book or not, but I hope that that can change, but I don't know if it will. It's a shame that we put young people's bodies on the line for dreams and wishes that we have, and I don't know. It's just sad, very sad.
Well, let me say that, you know, in this book, at times I'm quite critical of U.S. intelligence, though even in the case of the first war, some people did get it right. I wasn't one of them, but some people did get it right in terms of predicting accurately what Saddam Hussein would do, though the intelligence in the first war, one thing it got wrong was it underestimated, it's called a false negative, how far Saddam had advanced when it came to building weapons of mass destruction. Ironically enough, the second time around, intelligence got it wrong again, but this time with a false positive. They overestimated what Saddam Hussein had in the way of weapons of mass destruction. But as I also mentioned, I believe, earlier, one place intelligence got it right with the Second War wasn't predicting just how messy Iraq would be and how difficult it would be for the United States to try to bring order and bring democracy to Iraq. And the problem here wasn't with the intelligence. The problem was with policymakers who rejected this analysis because it didn't fit their policy preferences. So at the end of the day, intelligence is only half the story. Yes, it's obviously desirable, to say the least, that intelligence is right, but that's not enough. The other question is whether policymakers are open to what the intelligence analysts are telling them, and in my experience, that's not always the case.
Well, I agree there too. So, but it's sad that we have such a faulty system when it comes to the foreign policy and the things we end up doing because we. I don't know, because we have these assumptions about intelligence and...
But I agree, but on the other hand, it's not that different in my experience than, say, some of the imperfections in our healthcare system or our legal system. These are people with assumptions trying to do, if you will, diagnosis, and often doctors get it wrong, and often, in this case, intelligence analysts or policymakers get it wrong. Individuals make mistakes, and organizations make mistakes. And to me, I have a couple of lessons I draw from this. One is people have to be very careful about assumptions, and assumptions always have to be challenged. Something else is that before you invade a country or go to war with a country, you better make sure you really know it. And whether it was Vietnam or Iraq, I do not believe that American officials had a sufficiently deep understanding of the country that they were going to war with. And thirdly, process matters. And the first Bush administration under 41 was far more systematic, and even though they made some mistakes as well, it was a far more disciplined, rigorous, systematic look at options than the second Bush administration when it went to war. And there's no excuse for that. It seems to me that governments need to be careful and deliberate and thorough and make sure all points of view are heard. And it was done much better the first time around. It was not done terribly well in 2002, 2003.
You know, I want to thank the last caller, by the way. It seems to me that in the run-up to the Second War, there were people who were saying something like this. We don't doubt that the United States will be able to militarily defeat Saddam Hussein. You know, that's not the question. But we really should think very carefully about what happens the day after we win. And were there people within the administration who were saying, yes, we should pay attention to that? This is not, you know, the victories, the military part of it, that's one thing.
Right.
But, you know, this idea that we were presented with, that after we win, you know, we'll drive down the main street of Baghdad, people will throw rose petals, and then we'll say, okay, we've gotten rid of that bad guy for you, good luck. And the people of Iraq will say, thank you very much, and we'll carry on from here. Well, you know, it seems that little or no thought was given to just how badly things could go afterwards. Were there people within the administration saying, you know, holding up their hands and saying, hey, this is really important. We're ignoring a very significant issue here.
The short answer is yes. Let me give you three examples. One was the intelligence community. As I think I already mentioned, there were several analyses I actually asked that they be done, which predicted just how difficult and complex Iraq would be to deal with after it was defeated militarily. Secondly, you had a large program done within the State Department called the Future of Iraq Project that did an awful lot of planning for the aftermath. And then thirdly, my own office, I was in charge of policy planning for Colin Powell. We did a thorough look at every experience the United States had in the 20th century dealing with defeated countries, and we put together all the lessons, and I wrote the longest memo I've ever written in government. I wrote a 15-page single-space memo that summarized every single lesson the United States learned. Powell then gave the memo to the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, the national security advisor, and others, and it was all ignored. And people who favored the war didn't want to hear that it was going to be anything other than quick and easy. It's the reason they fought it with far fewer troops than they ever should have fought it. It's the reason they didn't plan systematically for the aftermath. They believed their own predictions. And the problem was it was all based on ideology and cotton candy. And as a result, the United States did not go about this correctly. It was not inevitable, I believe, that Iraq, that the Iraq War would turn out as poorly as it did for several years, or as costly as it did. I never thought it was going to be easy. But had the United States fought it, say, with three or four times as many troops, if we had planned systematically for the aftermath, it still would have been challenging. We still would have lost lives and so forth. But I believe the results would have been far better and the costs would have been far more modest.
Our guest, Richard Haass, is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He served in the Department of State as principal advisor to the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, in the second Bush administration at the time of the second Iraq War. He's written a book on this, War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars. We have 6-7 minutes left. Some other callers. We'll get as many as we can. Going next to someone in Champaign in line 3. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I got a couple quick questions and a short comment. One was, I remember hearing or reading that Paul O'Neill, the gentleman who's chosen to be treasurer, when he came out with his book, that that he heard people talking about invading Iraq in the first month he was in the position he held. I think it was Secretary of Treasury, maybe. And I always wondered if that was true or not. The second one was that what I remember is that when President Bush I went into Panama, that there were many people who thought that he violated the same international law that Saddam had violated when he went into Kuwait. And I don't know if that's true or not. It's something I've heard. And the comment is this, that I don't think the historians will be too confused in the long run. I think that at some point they'll be watching TV and 3 days of a condor will be on and they'll flash over and they'll see Cheney on Fox. And I think it'll be pretty clear what's been going on in terms of the underlying problems we've experienced in the last 20 years with Iraq. Thanks.
All right.
Well, it is correct in the sense it came out in the book about by Ron Susskind wrote about Paul O'Neill, who was Mr. Bush's first Secretary of the Treasury, and it talks about either the first or one of the first Cabinet or National Security Council meetings of the 43rd president, and the question of Iraq came up seemingly out of nowhere, but it didn't go anywhere. And every once in a while it would come up, but it didn't gain traction. And in my view, what had to happen in order for it to gain traction was 9/11. By that I mean, had 9/11 not happened, it's not clear to me this administration would have gone to war in Iraq. It was 9/11 that changed their outlook. It made them much more suspicious about the world, but perhaps more important, it made them interested in finding a way to send a message to the region and the world that again, the United States could shape history and not simply be shaped by history. So, yes, Iraq was on the minds of some people at the cabinet level and below, but I'm not sure they would have prevailed absent 9/11. The Panama invasion seems to me very different. The United States invaded Panama because the government of Panama was not fulfilling its sovereign responsibilities and, among other things, wasn't protecting Americans and others there. That seems to me to be a fundamentally different basis for using military force than the sort of thing Saddam did in Kuwait, which was simply an act of aggression and his desire not simply to occupy but to absorb a country. The United States wasn't after Panama in any way to absorb Panama into the United States. We're not there to somehow drain its resources. We were simply there to protect our interests.
All right. Next is Urbana. We're here where we are, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I missed the first half of the program. This might have been covered. I doubt it. But in connection with the first Gulf War, my impression at the time was that in the first few hours after the invasion, that the Bush 41 was not particularly upset or perturbed by this, according to his statements, and it was not until Margaret Thatcher weighed in and told him to buck up and get some courage and not put up with it.
I've heard that, and I go to great length to basically knock down that mythology in the book. Bush was actually right there from the get-go. I spoke to him I was there with him. Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor, and I were there with him when we learned of Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. We had a long talk after the first National Security Council meeting, and he was very clear about where he wanted things to go. He said, this will not stand. That Sunday, which was, what, 3 or 4 days into the crisis, not at the prompting of Mrs. Thatcher, though he had met with her earlier in the week. You know, this phrase, don't go wobbly, which took on a lot of, again, popular mythology, was mentioned by Mrs. Thatcher, but it was several weeks into the crisis, and it wasn't over the basic question to resist. It was over a more technical and smaller consideration of whether we waited for yet another UN resolution before we would begin to enforce the sanctions. She was getting impatient. Secretary of State Baker said, give me another 24 or 48 hours. I can keep this international consensus intact. Let's not rush using the use of force over the sanctions. So that's when she said, don't go wobbly. But the president listened to Baker, and Baker was successful with the members of the UN Security Council. So her impatience, I thought, was quite honestly ill-advised. But Bush didn't need any bucking up here. He and Scowcroft were there, I thought, literally from day one. And he was quite robust about what needed to be done and why this couldn't be allowed to stand.
We're just about out of time. I'm sorry, we have a couple of callers we can't take. Just one final question, and we'll have to be quick. The criticism that people made at the time about the first war that the United States stopped at the border of Kuwait, having driven out Saddam Hussein,
right.
You know, a lot of people said, well, why not go all the way to Baghdad?
I think the best way to justify the decision not to go to Baghdad in 1991 was how difficult to prove when we went to Baghdad in 2003. And all the kinds of problems that were experienced in 2003 and 2004 and 5 and 6 were anticipated a decade before, and we simply said, we do not want to put U.S. soldiers into that kind of a situation. We don't need to protect our basic interests.
Yeah. There we'll have to stop. Our guest, Richard Haass, is president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as director of policy planning in the Department of State, where he was principal advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell. This was from January 2001 until June 2003. He also served in the first Bush administration from 89 to 93 as special assistant to the President George H.W. Bush, and also senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the staff of the National Security Council. You want to read more of his thinking on these two wars, you look for his book, War of Necessity, War of Choice, a memoir of two Iraq wars. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And Dr. Haass, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents Champaign-Urbana at its best.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. WILL is a listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the recession. The fallout from the economic downturn has been extensive. Many people are struggling, but many people are lending a helping hand. This afternoon, we'll hear stories of hope and connection as we take a look at area organizations helping people in need put food on the table. Three guests will join us in the 1 o'clock hour this afternoon of the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests will be Marie Brown, Scott Althoff, and Jim Hines. Marie Brown is a volunteer and recipient of the services of Salt and Light Ministry. Scott Althoff is a financial counselor for the Salt and Light Ministry, and Jim Hires is the executive director for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. They'll join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, September wheat is trading at 4.91 and three quarters, down 7. December, 5.08 and a quarter, down 6 and three quarters. Chicago, September wheat, 4.59, down 10. December, 4.86 and a half, down 10. September corn, 3.19 and a quarter, up three quarters. December, 3.23 and a half, down one half. March, 336 and three quarters, down 1/2. May, 346 and a half, down 1/4. September beans, 1018 and a quarter, up 19. November, 969 and a half, up 12 and a half. January, 972 and a half, up 13. March, 965, up 5 1/2. September meal, 332.10, up 5.10. Excuse me, that's up 5.20. 332.10 for September meal, up 5.20. September oil, 36.12, up 32. At the Merck in Chicago, August live cattle, 84.